Genesis 22:1. And it came to pass after these things that God did tempt Abraham, and said unto him, Abraham. And he said, Behold, here I am. And he said, Take now thy son, thine only son, Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of. And Abraham rose up early in the morning, and saddled his ass, and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and clave the wood for the burnt offering, and rose up, and went unto the place of which God had told him. Then in the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes, and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said unto his young men, Abide ye here with the ass, and I and the lad will go yonder and worship, and come again to you. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering, and laid it upon Isaac his son. And he took the fire in his hand, and a knife, and they went both of them together. And Isaac spake unto Abraham his father, and said, My father. And he said, Here am I, my son. And he said, Behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? And Abraham said, My son, God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering. So they went both of them together. And they came to the place which God had told them of. And Abraham built an altar there, and laid the wood in order, and bound Isaac his son, and laid him on the altar upon the wood. And Abraham stretched forth his hand, and took the knife to slay his son. And the angel of the Lord called unto him out of heaven, and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, Here am I. And he said, Lay not thine hand upon the lad, neither do thou anything unto him. For now I know that thou fearest God, seeing thou hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, from me. And Abraham lifted up his eyes, and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. And Abraham went and took the ram, and offered him up for a burnt offering in the stead of his son. And Abraham called the name of that place Jehovah Jireh, as it is said to this day, In the mount of the Lord it shall be seen. And the angel of the Lord called unto Abraham out of heaven the second time, and said, By myself have I sworn, saith the Lord, for because thou hast done this thing, and hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, that in blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of the heaven, and as the sand which is upon the seashore, and thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because thou hast obeyed my voice. So Abraham returned unto his young men, and arose up, and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham dwelt at Beersheba. May God bless to us the further reading from his holy word. This book has a different way of dealing with things from any earthly textbook that I know. I take it that in an earthly textbook, it would be normal to give a title to a chapter and to bring all the various fragments of thought on that particular title within that one chapter. But mind you, that's not really human experience. For strictly speaking, we learn in a different fashion, don't we? Here a little, there a little. And I take it that the way in which God spoke to Abraham is the much more normal way of learning. I can never make up my mind whether God spoke to him seven times or eight, but it's around about that number. And I take it that it was just this, Abraham, you won't receive lesson number two until you've learned lesson number one. Abraham, you won't receive lesson number three until you've learned lesson number two. And so on. And for that reason, God appeared to him those seven or eight different times. We've been hearing, for instance, that lesson number one came in Ur of the Chaldees. Lesson number two didn't come for a long time. didn't come until the encumbrances had been shed, until the obstacles had been overcome. I wonder, have you reached lesson number 2 in the school of God yet? I'm not asking how long you've been in the way. I'm asking, have you learned lesson number, have you come to lesson number 2 yet? If you haven't, there's only one reason I can suggest, and that is that lesson number 1 hasn't been fully learned. Isn't that it? And so, as Abraham rose in spiritual stature, God would meet him and give him another revelation of himself. That's how he still works, beloved. He teaches us our lessons as we have learned the previous one. Now I take it that when we come to chapter 22, we have come to the peak point of Abraham's spiritual experience. We've been learning that he knew what it was to pass through the slough of despot. He's a strange Christian who doesn't know that experience. He lives in an artificial surrounding entirely, doesn't he? But we mustn't be preoccupied with that kind. We must look at the other as well. We must, of course, comment when we look at the other kind of experience, just as Paul commented in Philippians chapter 3, not as though I had already attained. But of course, we must keep striving after, mustn't we? In other words, keep the lesson before us if we haven't reached the peak point. And who is presumptuous enough to claim that he has? Still and all, we must recognize that it's there and aspire to it, to the kind of experience that Abraham had here in Genesis chapter 22. You know the story well. We simply wish to use it this evening to illustrate certain well-known biblical truths which ought to be the practice of every child of God. For instance, once we come to the little epistle of James, we discover another mention of Abraham, don't we? In fact, I am led to believe that Martin Luther wasn't very fond of that epistle at all, because he found it very, very difficult to reconcile it with the epistle to the Romans. We should always remember that there's a great vision yonder in Ezekiel chapter 1, which shows two wheels turning in perfect unison without actually touching each other. They don't contradict each other, they just turn in perfect unison. And I take it that the two great aspects of the truth of justification work just like that. We've been hearing about justification by faith, whereby Abraham simply took God at his word, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. Abbot, says James, was not Abraham justified by work? And we're told when he was justified by work. In other words, it was when he reached his experience right here in Genesis chapter 22. Now, isn't this just exactly what evangelicals are taxed with constantly? Oh yes, it's all preaching with you folks. You proclaim from the housetops, I hope we're still doing it, that a man is justified by faith. I wonder if we've forgotten the other side of the coin. I wonder if we've produced the evidence. Isn't that the whole point of the last paragraph of James' second chapter? Why, says the apostle, listen, you prove you're justified by faith by going on to manifest your work. You prove that you believe God by going on to produce the fruit of believing in God. And I take it that that is exactly what Abraham is doing here. Why, there he is, he's promised a land that was possessed by, well, is it 7 nations? I forgot to count as Mr. Stalin was reading. It's called 7 elsewhere in the Old Testament, isn't it? Imagine standing on the borders of that land and being told, I'm going to give you it. And all the time you see Amorites and all the rest in possession. It took a lot of faith to believe that one, didn't it? Imagine standing there, an old man, with a wife almost as old, barren at that, and being told that that land would belong to your feet. Yes, he believed all that. He believed all that, and it was counted unto him for righteousness. And now here's the lad, presumably grown up, the light of his parents' life. And God tells him, did you not notice the description each time Isaac's referred to? Thy son, thine only son, Isaac. Oh, it almost felt as if the knife was being turned in the wound, so to speak. Offer him up. Let's prove if you still believe in God. If you still believe in taking everything he says at its face value. Did he? Well, isn't it magnificent, beloved? He had reached the point of believing God absolutely. He had reached the point of not doubting God in the slightest. He had reached the point of proving that he believed everything that God said. This is even further on than the promise of Isaac originally. I mean, it's a tremendous statement made quite a number of times in God's book. With God, nothing shall be impossible. Or to put it Job's way, I believe that thou canst do everything. After all, it's the natural corollary to believing in a God who is omnipotent, omniscient, isn't it? There's nothing impossible with him. Right, God knew, Abraham knew God well when he reached this point, hadn't he? When he was able just to take God at his word, to obey his most exacting command, to trust him absolutely and implicitly. This is justification by works. I wonder if we're practicing them, are we? Yes, that is the great point at which he reached here. Beloved, have we turned to the other side of the coin? Are we proving to our neighbours, to our friends and workmates, that we really have been justified by faith, by going on to demonstrate it in this kind of fashion, justified by works? But then, when we come to Genesis chapter 22, I take it that we have reached the point where Abraham demonstrates in great measure the truth of a little phrase that's used in the New Testament. You remember it? Romans chapter 12, present your bodies a living sacrifice. I better watch that one. I've been getting told that there's a difference between an offering and a sacrifice. And a sacrifice is something that's offered dead, or offered to be slain might be better, whereas an offering might not be. I'm not so sure yet. We'll have to argue that one out before this day or two are over. But my point is just this, that there may be two illustrations of a living sacrifice in the Old Testament. We possibly had an illustration of one mentioned last evening in connection with Jephthah's daughter. Here is the other great example. And of course, I want to bring this home to us. Here is Abraham being asked to offer a living sacrifice in the person of his own son Isaac. We've been mentioning the details already. Oh yes, from the human point of view, it must have been painful, but it indicates just how much this man had got to know God. You know that he's one of the very few in this book who's called the friend of God. Imagine being in intimate terms with God. Mind you, that's a few chapters further back, isn't it? That was in connection with Sodom that God said about Abraham, shall I hide from him the things that I'm going to do? The friendship has ripened and deepened. There is greater understanding still, closer fellowship. So much so that Abraham is able to offer this living sacrifice. You young folks, I wonder if you've ever faced up to this one. I don't hear so much about it these days, but from time to time the whole business of a second blessing comes up. There's just the possibility that the folks who advocate it are quite well-meaning in their intention. In other words, they look around and they see a tremendous amount of humdrum Christianity. And they say, listen, we must do better. And they go on to insist that a person must have a new experience. Well, I think we've been teaching already that the capacity for every spiritual experience was acquired at the moment of conversion. But there's just the possibility that Romans chapter 12 needs to be a distinct experience in the lives of most of us. I mean, distinct from conversion. Not many of us behave as Paul did. Acknowledge Jesus Christ as Lord and immediately ask him for a marching order, do we? Not many of us say, Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? And carry on with a marching order. Beloved, perhaps that for most of us comes a bit later. I'm anxious that it shouldn't come for any of us, never. I'm anxious that it should be a very real experience for each of us. You know where it comes in Paul's epistle, don't you? He's argued out the gospel. He's shown it in all its immensity. And now he says, we've surveyed the mercies of God. How he can justify the ungodly. And now, says he, have you no gratitude at all? Do you not appreciate the mercies of God? Do they mean anything to you? If you do, you take that body. You take it and present it, a living sacrifice. Holy, acceptable unto God. And he says, you know, it's quite logical. It's your logical service. The hymn writer virtually paraphrased it, didn't he? Not that I have, mine own I'll call. I'll hold it for the giver. It belongs to him anyway, doesn't it? Will you withhold him from him? Will you deny him it? Take your body. Present it a living sacrifice. Wasn't the wise man who said that a living dog was better than a dead lion? I feel that some of us would nearly welcome the opportunity of being martyrs for Jesus Christ. I don't know what you would accomplish that way, mind you. He's far more anxious that you should live for him than that you should die for him. That's what a living sacrifice is. There's a certain amount of glamour about the other, and I wouldn't belittle for a moment the sacrifice of anybody who has required to lay down his life for Jesus Christ. But I've just the feeling that some of us would rather dream about doing that than be living sacrifices at the moment. Coming along to the altar and saying, take my life, take my body, take me. Well, that was the point that Abraham had reached right here in Genesis chapter 22. He was presenting a living sacrifice. He had come to the peak point of his spiritual experience, you see. What is the highest spiritual exercise? It's mentioned in the chapter, isn't it? I and the lad will go yonder and worship. Worship. I wonder if we're practiced in this spiritual exercise. Service is tremendously important. Perhaps many of us are engaging in it far too little. But here is the highest spiritual exercise, that of worship. This is what Abraham is doing here in Genesis chapter 22. I wonder if we know much about it. One, not only at the moment, speaking about the gathering of the Lord's people on a Lord's Day morning. I'm speaking about worship in every aspect. I wonder whether do it privately. I've just the feeling that yon hymn describes it perfectly. Lost in holy wonder. You've got many an example of it in the New Testament. Why, from time to time, the Apostle Paul in particular, although you will find examples in other books of the New Testament, has simply swept off his feet with wonder. It's what we call a doxology. When he's virtually lost, and he'll say, oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. Isn't that worship? A dear brother on the other side who lost his life in a pit accident once used the very passage from which we were, to which we were referring this afternoon, to describe worship. He said, worship takes place when you're out of your depth. Out of your depth. And of course, in that case, you don't offer yourself, really, do you? And you don't offer your service. No, you offer God's Son. You say to God, oh, what a wonderful Christ. That's worship. And that's virtually the point that Abraham had reached here in his spiritual experience. Of course, you've got to love the Lord Jesus before you can bow to him like that, haven't you? You've got to view the wonderful features of his life and death and earth until you can do nothing but wonder. For I would take it that wonder must precede worship. Well, that was the point that Abraham had reached here. He was just going to worship God. He was going to do it by offering up his son, his only Isaac. I wonder if we're as much in love with God as just want to worship him, express to him the greatness, the wonder of his person. Of course, Abraham believed in resurrection, didn't he? This is a great point that emerges from Hebrews chapter 11. This is virtually an extension of what we have been speaking about already, where Abraham was called upon to offer up Isaac. I don't believe he went doubting, hesitating. You might say, oh well, of course, the culmination of a life of faith means that you can believe God all the time and believe God any time. Beloved, I take it that when God would teach us to trust him, he will seldom seek to teach us the same lesson in the same way, twice over. I mean, it's all very well for human reasoning to look at this story and say, oh yes, Isaac was a miracle. God was still the God of the miraculous, even when Isaac was growing up, just as he had been when Isaac was born. The God who made Sarah's womb fertile when it was trebly impossible can surely do it again. Beloved, that wouldn't have required faith in Abraham's part. God doesn't do the same thing in the same way twice over. Otherwise, we would rely on our previous knowledge. We would trust in our previous experience. God insisted that it was in Isaac that Abraham's seed was to be called. No substitute could be raised up. Therefore, Isaac must survive Mount Moriah. And isn't that the great point of Hebrews chapter 11? Believing that God was able to raise him from the dead, from whence also he received him in a figure. For all those promises contained in Genesis 15, repeated, added to, all of them were vested in one person, in thy seed, and that seed was one. Isn't that the point that Mr. Newberry brings out in the Epistle to the Galatians? Why, the very number of the word is singular, in thy seed. Nobody else, no substitute, no Ishmael, no successor to Isaac. It must be Isaac. And so, there the two of them set off from home that morning, and those almost poignant words, repeated within the chapter, so they went both of them together. They went both of them together. And what I'm saying, beloved, is that old Abraham, for he was no longer young, old Abraham believed that no matter what happened in Mount Moriah, his God could give him not another son, not a substitute for Isaac, but Isaac back again. I wonder if we have simple faith like that. The peak point of a spiritual experience. I like to look at the life of Abraham as the search for a city. I'm again borrowing from Hebrews chapter 11. A city of habitation. A city where pilgrims at the last settle down. We've been hearing about the countries, I like to call them cities, which Abraham touched during the course of his pilgrim career. Any one of them would have beckoned him. He refused to settle down. Egypt. No, that's the place where you deny the relationship. Young Christian, it still is. It's the place where you will deny that you belong to God. And so on, here in the halfway house, Sodom, so on. Yes, it was the search for a city. Mind you, will you please notice that this was not a poor soldier. On the contrary, he was very wealthy. Very wealthy. This doesn't detract from his pilgrim character. Beloved, it enhances it. Why, surely there was all the more temptation for Abraham to settle down because of the abundance of his possessions. Let's give credit where it's due. In spite of the fact that he was wealthy, he remained a pilgrim. I trust that we're all as simple in our faith in that respect. That no matter how much we acquire of this world's goods and gear, that no matter how well we go on, we'll still be true pilgrims at heart. We'll still be looking for God's city. We'll still believe that what He has promised us is far greater than all we've acquired. That was Abraham's position. I take it that in Genesis chapter 22, at least he arrives at the site of the city. It wasn't there yet. No, in a sense, he was just receiving it in a figure too. But he had arrived at its site, hadn't he? In addition to that, he had arrived at the site of the future temple, hadn't he? He had arrived at the house of God, so to speak. I'm taking it that this was the very place, Mount Moriah, on which King Solomon proceeded to build that wonderful temple. And of course, that was in Old Jerusalem, which didn't exist at this time. And here's Abraham, the peak point of his spiritual experience, arrived at a city that was non-existent. And he still believed God. He still trusted Him. He arrived at the site of the house of God. Beloved, we don't wish to be pharisaical. We don't wish to be presumptuous. I take it, though, that for the Christian today, the house of God is that which is mentioned in yon closing verses of 1 Timothy chapter 3, the chapter of the living God. For those things mentioned in those two chapters are intended to be practiced. We've been hearing a little this afternoon about baptism. It's then the intention of the living God that His people should be associated with Him in just such a house. That they should come just to such a site, and they take up the residence, so to speak, for all the days of the flesh. I take it that what is involved in arriving at this peak point of a spiritual experience. Now then, how does God view it? How does God view it? You know, I just look at those closing verses from 15 onwards, and I feel that it's nearly equivalent to the heavens bursting and expressing divine pleasure with the pilgrim Abraham. By myself have I sworn. Abraham, I've nothing more to promise you, but I want to make assurance doubly sure. I want to underline and emphasize everything I've ever promised you. Abraham, I'm delighted with you. You've proved yourself beyond the shadow of a doubt. You've proved that you love me more than anything and anybody else and everything else in this world. Abraham, by myself have I sworn that in blessing I will bless thee, and so on. I wonder if you're concerned with God's pleasure. I'm thinking of those middle chapters of 1 Corinthians. With many of them, God was not well pleased. I wonder if it's your anxiety and mine that with us, God should be well pleased. I take it that here He is expressing His pleasure with Abraham. He had promised him the land. He had promised him a seed. He had revealed to him a great deal about the future. He's nothing more to tell him. But He's saying, almost in ecstasy, Abraham, by myself have I sworn that in blessing I will bless thee. And in multiplying, I will multiply thee. You remember how the writer to the Hebrews borrowed from it? Men verily swear by the greater. And an oath for confirmation is to them an end of all strife, an end of all controversy. If in other words you're prepared to swear an oath, it means that you're guaranteeing the truth of what you've been saying. Now that's exactly what God is doing to Abraham. What's that? Well, he couldn't swear by any greater, could he? And so he swore by himself. He made assurance doubly sure. He gave two impossible things on which, from the human point of view, in which it was impossible for God to lie. This is the kind of promise that he's making to Abraham. He swore by his own name, the name of the everlasting God, which he sought to add to the promise of the everlasting one. Two things that in which it was impossible for God to lie. Yes, we also ought to have this kind of anchor for our souls, shouldn't we? Just as Abraham had it. He's a little longer to live. It almost appears his life was uneventful. He's simply resting in the everlasting arms, so to speak. He's got from God promises beyond recall. Promises unparalleled. Many of them still not fulfilled, but absolutely guaranteed. And there he rests, trusting in almightiness. Beloved, this is the kind of target which God has for all of his pilgrims. The peak point of a spiritual experience. That little word perfect is used in such vague and various ways in Holy Scripture that it's always difficult to arrive at finality about its meaning. But yonder in Genesis chapter 16, God did say to Abraham, "Abraham, walk before me and be thou perfect." If it could possibly be used to apply to any of Abraham's experiences, and I'm recalling the frequent use of the same word in the Epistle to the Hebrews, it surely is right here in Genesis chapter 22. Beloved, as we study his story, we who have a far greater opportunity to be intimate with God can still borrow a tremendous amount from him, knowing just how simply he learned to trust. What an apt pupil he was, in spite of setbacks. He had downs as well as ups. But may each one of us follow on to know God just as intimately as did the aged patriarch.